Welcome to Your Right to Speak, discussions on child and youth rights and advocacy. This is episode 16, and I'm your host, Salvatore. And we have Jen on the phone because she's unable to be here physically for the episode. So, Jen, do you want to say hi?
Hi, everyone. Hope you're doing good.
Today, we'll be talking with Stuart, who works here at an agency called The Gatehouse. And we'll be continuing our topic on sexual abuse that we've started a couple of episodes ago. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to dive into this. Stuart, would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you for having me on the show. I really, really appreciate it. And my name is Stuart Thompson, and I am a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. And well, I'm as Sammy pointed out, I'm at the Gatehouse. I'm a volunteer facilitator. I came as a participant, and here I am.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out to be with us on the show today. Really appreciate it. We're just going to dive into the questions, and we're going to see where this conversation takes us.
Fantastic.
So we're going to just start off of, what's your definition of sexual abuse?
Well, my definition of sexual abuse, and that's a really good question to start off with, because especially with what we're talking about, my definition of sexual abuse, I mean, anybody can look it up in the dictionary and actually find the definition, or go on to Wikipedia and find it there, but my definition would be unconsensual sex, basically is what it is. And and we're talking about, since we're talking about sexual abuse with children, then it would be sexual abuse with a child or sexual abuse with a minor. So that's basically where I see that as. It's pretty cut and dry.
I think that's a great definition. Yeah. Straight to the point.
Yeah, straight to the point.
So how did you get started? I know you touched upon it a bit before, but how did you get started here at the Gatehouse?
Well, I came here 6 years ago as a participant. And I was in really, really not in good shape. I really did not have much value in life, pertaining to my own life, that is. And I was basically on skid row. And this was my last kick of the can, as I'd say. I'm 55 years of age now, but at that time, I did not see any light at the end of my tunnel. So I was desperate, and I needed to talk about this, because the stigma behind childhood sexual abuse, well, it's still very prominent in society nowadays. And, you know, even talking about domestic violence is another stigma, as another example, where it is not talked about very readily. In amongst the community, or in the schools, or any of the social agencies, unless it's an issue where someone's been charged, or that's the only time it ever seems to come up in conversation. Mm-hmm.
I think that's such a great point, that it really is not something talked about a lot. With my background in child and youth care that I had done at Humber, it was a conversation that we often talked about, but that's because I needed to do that for my training. And I don't know about you, Jen, how often you talk about it in your courses in psychology, but I do find that it's a topic mm-hmm. that's often kind of left quiet and really swept
or quickly glanced over.
Yeah, that's, I love the way you put that. Absolutely.
I think that's a great point. So I just want to give the listeners a bit of context, because I think this is a great agency. What does the Gatehouse do exactly, and what really makes this place a special place?
Well, as I pointed out for myself when I first came here, the Gatehouse, if you were to go online to www.thegatehouse.org, and you go onto our website, but what we cater to here is, if you're a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, and from the age of 18 to 150, if you are, as per se, I know that's extreme, but that's the case. But if you're 18 to that age, or any age, you can come as an adult, and you can get peer support. And what the Gatehouse also offers as well, this is also a place for the police, the Toronto Police, or York Region, or Peel, or even the OPP. They can come here and do an investigation with the child through CSA and the police as well. And this place is not, the Gatehouse is like an old house. It's a 150-year-old house. You know, as from coming here, Sammy, mm-hmm. what it's like. It doesn't look like a police station. It doesn't look like a hospital. It doesn't even look like a medical clinic. It's just an old house with beautiful, beautiful energy. As much negative energy that comes in here, there's a lot of positive energy that goes out of the house as well.
Yes, I would agree. I mean, when I first started volunteering here, the energy it's indescribable. Walking through the doors, you get a very positive feeling, in a sense, right? It's it's really hard to describe. The energy here is great. And if you see up the staircases, you can see the teddy bears, and it's a really warming and welcoming environment, which I think is so important, particularly when children do come here.
And adults too.
And adults too, yes, exactly. That's a great point. Now, I know from the past, I'm not too sure if it's still done, but whenever a child comes here with
the police,
yeah. Is there, I know we used to do this, but do we still give the child like a teddy bear or something?
Actually the place is full of toys. It's full of teddy bears, but we also have a host of other toys. If you were to go to the closet upstairs, mm-hmm. it's just rammed full of toys. And we had a teddy bear drive last year. And we got literally hundreds and hundreds of them. And now we've kind of put a halt on that now because mm-hmm. we only have so many. But even as an adult, I got a teddy bear when I came here first phase one program. And if you're an adult and you would like one, well, we encourage you to take one because it kind of brings you back to your childhood, mm-hmm. Which we lost. But yes, primarily, we generally give children that come in here that have been through this experience and after the investigation, the police will automatically CSA, we combine, will give them either a teddy bear or one of the toys to take home with them as well.
As far as I know, this is the only place that actually does that.
Yes, that I'm aware of.
Yeah, so that's so unique.
In the world.
In
the world.
It's very unique, and I think it just gives an example of how the energy is and the understanding of the volunteers here. And it's really hard to explain to the viewers or listeners. Sorry. Jen, did you want to go on?
Yes. So I was wondering, you thought, cause I know you work there now as well.
I volunteer, not work, just volunteer.
Do you think being a male volunteer working in that sort of environment and with that topic, affects how you interact with the survivors, if there's like pros or cons to it?
Well, there is pros and cons, and I'll elaborate a little bit more on that. Well, the definite pros that are along with this, right off the beat, is that we can relate to one another. And I don't care whether you're a woman or a man. And the cons behind it. Well, obviously, between the two genders, there's going to be some differences. And that's why when we do groups here, for the first 15 weeks, we have a women's program and we have a men's program. And then after they've done that, then we do a co-ed program. And this is where the subtle differences come in because, like for example, now how I may think about my sexuality versus a woman, for example, or will be totally, totally different, for example, as one point. And another point where there's an obvious difference is where men will have a problem with their masculinity, for example, well, women will not have that issue, obviously. So there is subtle differences, but our general thoughts and cares towards ourselves are pretty much the same.
Okay.
I have to ask this because Jen's not here. Is there anything else you want to add to that, Jen?
No, I think that satisfied the answer. I think that's very, it's interesting to think about, so I'm just like processing it all. Do you think like a woman would be better suited to, I guess, be paired with like a male peer or a female peer? Like, which do you think would be better for, or is it just individual case by case?
Well, it is individual case by case because everybody comes in here with different types of anxieties and stress, and therefore everybody has different needs. Now, we encourage people, both men and women, to get together after they've done the first 15-week program because even though the subtle differences that I've – or the pros and cons as we just discussed are obvious and they're there – but I found for myself, and I know from a lot of other men, and I know this, women have said this too, that, for example, now I was abused by a woman as well. I was abused on both sides. So therefore, I need the insight from a woman, whether I agree with it or not agree with it. I still need to have women around, talking to them, because I have huge trust issues, but in a setting like this, this is the perfect spot to talk to somebody and feel safe about it, whether you're a woman or a man. And as far as gender is concerned, yes, I think it does come into play, and there is special needs from time to time, but I think it's very important for both sexes to get together and to talk about what happened to them, so each side understands. Because And like, for example, now, a lot of cases with women, for example, majority of their abusers are men to begin with. Mm-hmm. And in the men's situation, for example, even their situation, majority of their abusers are men. There's only a small percentage, and I don't know the percentage, but there is I shouldn't say a small percentage, but there's still a great percentage mm-hmm. of men that have been abused by women as well. And that, like, speaking for myself, that creates a lot of confusion. And as the points I pointed out with the pros and cons, like masculinity, sexuality, for example, mm-hmm. self-esteem, there's a whole jar of anxieties that are in that jar that could potentially come up throughout your lifetime.
So when someone has gone through the... How many stages is it for the peer program?
So we have a 15-week program for the men and for the women separate, and then we have a 16-week program where it's co-ed.
And so when they're done the 16-week one, can they start from the very beginning again?
Or? Yes, that's the beautiful thing about coming to the Gatehouse, is that you can do the programs as many times as you like. And one thing I may point out, which is very important, all these programs are free. There's no charge for the programs whatsoever. There's no money. If you want to leave money at the door and at the bucket, you're quite welcome to make a donation. You're quite welcome to do so. But anybody who comes in here is not expected to leave a dime. No expectation. The only expectation is you come in here to heal.
That is such a great concept. Because I think for people to come into a service and not having to worry about payment or anything like that, they're just coming here to heal, is something that I think we need in other services.
Absolutely.
I can just imagine, you know, just the stress of trying to figure out, okay, well, I need this service, you know, it's great, it helps a whole bunch of people, but I have to find the means now to get to that, right, to pay for that service. So yes. Knowing that it's free, and just concentrating on healing was great. I mean, there's...
Yeah, can I add a couple more
things
to that?
Yeah, for sure.
And one of the beautiful things about it is, too, now you got to keep in mind, as I've stated from the beginning, this is peer support now. Mm-hmm. We do have therapists that are volunteer here, but the concept of what we do is a form of cognitive behavioral therapy. But the idea is that when we facilitate, for example, we may drop a seed of an experience, but the idea is the participant to do the talking. And it's about gaining our voice back. And if you were to throw money into it, I mean, this is going to seem kind of odd, but if you were to throw money into that situation, it'd be totally, totally different. So mm-hmm. when you take the equation of money out of it, as far as I'm concerned, it makes it a lot easier for the person coming in here that's under that sort of duress and their period of their lifetime, that they don't have to worry about it. They can just come in here, talk about what's going on, and slowly heal to move forward.
I think that's great. I just want to change our topic just a little bit.
Sure.
In terms of, and I know this from my training and some of the research I've done, there's not a lot of services out there for men who have been sexually abused.
That's correct.
What are your thoughts on that? How do we go about maybe getting more services or like...
Well, there's a couple components that are very important to your question, and I'm really happy you asked me that question, because I'm a crazy advocate for survivors, whether you're a man or a woman, but men being the big issue, as you pointed out. There's not enough agencies now. If you go online to malesurvivor.org, for example, they're based out of the U.S., but they do supply services here in Canada and in the U.S., primarily in the U.S., but you have to pay for those services, as for example. Okay, so if you were to go to a weekend retreat, for example, it could cost you $1,500, for example.
Oh my gosh.
American, for example, if you go down to the U.S. If it's Canadian, well, it won't be quite as much, but you still have to pay for that service. There is other agencies out there. For example, there's Men of Hope in Ottawa, for example. I believe that agency is free. But don't quote me on that. If I understand correctly, it is. There's only very few agencies around the world that are offering that for free. But as far as being enough of them is concerned, to your question you're talking about, no, there's not enough. And it's people like myself that advocate and other men that I know through social media that are trying to change this. And fact is, I'm crossing my fingers, but by... through Twitter, which it'll be, there will be the very first support chat for men anywhere that's never ever been done. Like we're starting on the 19th of November is our goal. And it's going to be a survivor chat through Twitter. And myself and two other gentlemen, two other gentlemen from the U.S. are trying to orchestrate this now. And it'll be totally free. And we feel now, and I see from social media, not just social media, via through the internet, but, seeing people and looking through news and just talking to people, just seeing what's going on in the world. I would say now is the time. Because awareness now, I've seen a shift in the last 6 to 10 years where awareness has come to a whole new level. I mean, it's in the news every day. Like use John Gomeshi as an example right there, as actually a bad example, but a good example of what justice is and where people want to talk. Now, granted, this was towards women where they were sexually violated, but being able as a man to come forward and talk about it and having finding a safe place to go is very rare, and like the Gatehouse is very rare, and there's very few places. But I honestly believe with what I've been telling you that that's going to change. There'll be more, but men have this stigma where we were brought up that we keep our chins up and we don't talk about this stuff. And if there's culture involved in this, which in 9 times out of 10 it is, then that makes it even worse. It makes it even harder to talk about it. Depending where you come from. So to bring this out and to talk about this stuff and to bring more agencies in, yes, I there's lack of now, but I do honestly believe that in the future there will be more. As awareness becomes more in the mainstream, which it is now, and people like myself and other people out there that are advocating to try to change this, will happen.
So how, because you mentioned the Twitter survivor chat, once or if that gets started, how would, let's say, if one of the listeners wants to partake in that, how can they get that?
Well, right off, it'll be a chat. It won't be a it won't be a video or an audio chat.
Okay.
It'll just be a chat through text, through Twitter. And the beautiful thing about that and the stigmas that I just pointed out about being a man or a woman, and it doesn't matter either way, but for a man, that's what we're talking about. You don't even have to identify who you are. You can go in there and be who you are and not even say your name, not even show your face. And you could talk about what's bothering you.
Will there be a link?
There'll be a link. In fact, myself through my blog show that I have as well. I'll be posting it on Facebook, and plus I will posting it on my Twitter account as well.
Okay, perfect.
And which I will do, Sammy, when I know for sure, I'll make sure this information is passed on to you either through Maria or myself.
Okay, perfect. And we'll even post a link to your blog show as well, so
beautiful.
The listeners
appreciate
can
that.
Continue on with that.
Beautiful. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. So in terms of, sorry, Jenna, did you want to go on and ask the next question? I was going to steal that from you.
Yes. I know you're mentioning how it's important for men and women to, I guess, work together in this process. But I was wondering, what do you think the differences are in the support that men need versus what the support looks like for women?
Well, I mean, right off the hop, there's the obvious difference between a male and a female. Now, when we talk about our feelings and we talk about what our needs are, I mean, I can't really answer to what all the needs of a woman would be, because I only going from what experience what I see here, but there's obvious differences in what we need as far as care is concerned and what we talk about. Generally, a lot of the stuff we talk about here at the Gatehouse are pretty much the same topics, other than the obvious differences I pointed out, meaning that where I may be struggling with masculinity and where a woman may be struggling with being feminine, because depending on what type of domestic violence they've received or childhood sexual abuse will hinder on those points or those things I just pointed out to you, where in some cases, while where a woman would be better to talk with a woman, and a man would be better to talk with a man, because for them to have that basic understanding of what they're thinking and feeling, well, it's obviously not going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, with the gender differences. So, yes, I'm sure the empathy is there. It's definitely here, but there are some basic understandings where women have certain issues. I mean, I don't know all of them, and I will not pretend that I do, but other than what I've like stated, for example, are always in the forefront. Hopefully I answered that question.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I know we've talked a little bit about the how the Gatehouse just offers peer support, which is very important. Do you also think that possibly the Gatehouse should be including individual counseling, or do you think that will change kind of what has been set up here?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked me that too, because I should have talked about that right from the beginning. Well, we do offer individual counseling. Oh. We do offer one-on-ones, which I do quite readily. With people that are not ready for groups. And the idea of doing one-on-ones with them is, they may never do a group, but it's also in preparation so they can do a group. Mm-hmm. Depending on where, and I've done both with men and women, and it doesn't really matter, you know, whether they do go to a group or not. The idea is, as being in a group, is trying to find your voice. And if you've been traumatized that much, and you come into a place like this, and you've got no trust for anybody, and the fact is that you were brave enough to come up these stairs, come in here, and to talk to even one person, let alone, never mind a group, you're pretty brave to be able to do that.
You've mentioned a couple of times being able to find your voice. Can you go in a bit more detail of what that means for our listeners, so they can have a more...
Well, and another great question, too. How I found my voice? Well, being a man, and... I was abused from the age of started from the age of 6 or 7 right through till I was 12, 13, where I was able to fight back. But within saying that, and the way I was brought up, and I'm in my mid-50s now, so the way I was brought up in old school ways, we didn't talk about this stuff. I couldn't even talk about this to my doctor, because mm-hmm. he wouldn't have known how to deal with it. And not only that, but I was ashamed. Mm-hmm. I blamed myself, although that's all BS as far as that's concerned. I was a child.
Yeah.
But try to tell that to an adult, whether you're a man or a woman, whether they're in their 40s or 50s, whether they believed all their life it was their fault. Mm-hmm. It's just not that simple. Mm-hmm. Granted, it's BS, it's lies, but we've been basically brainwashed or short-circuited to think like that. And if we've been groomed by our perpetrator, then even as an adult, we're going to carry those thoughts on. Am I answering the question? There's one more part of the question here that...
I don't entirely remember what I asked fully, but you've made a great point. I was asking of like how, so in the peer group you had mentioned it's about finding voice.
Yes.
That was the second part.
Yeah. So as far as finding our voice is concerned, well, when I came here 6 years ago, I didn't have a voice.
Okay.
I was passive aggressive. I would isolate, disassociate. I would shut. I any kind of emotion from a woman or a man or anybody, I would shut down.
Mm-hmm.
So, when I came here, I learned all about that stuff. I understood. I knew that stuff was going inside me, but I didn't know how to handle it. I didn't know how to deal with it. But by coming here, and being able to talk about what happened to me as a child, that gave me my voice, to the level that I am here right mm-hmm. now.
So would you say that part of finding the voice is kind of changing the way you think in a sense?
Yes, it is. It's kind of changed the way I think. Well, I was under the belief before I came here that I couldn't talk about it. I came in here and I found a new belief that I can talk about it, and I can feel safe about it, and I'm not going to be judged or ridiculed, and I actually can talk about it where somebody will understand, where outside the house nobody will understand.
That's great. You totally answered my question, and I was about to steal Jen's other question now, but Jen, please go ahead.
Yes. I was wondering, because I know over some people there's like this stigma or that this belief that if someone was sexually abused, that afterwards they would end up, when they grow up, to become an offender.
I just love these questions. I just love this. You know, I'm sure, were you finished with the question, or did you want to add more onto that?
Yeah, I just wanted to know what you would like people to say about that.
You're breaking up.
Sorry, Jen, you're breaking up. Can you repeat that, please?
Yes, I just wanted to know your thoughts on it, and what you would, I guess, like to tell society about that stigma. and that idea.
Okay, well, lucky for me, and that I've been here for a while now, and I've had a chance to, well, okay, first off, to the first part of the question. Now, this is fact, that that anybody who's been sexually abused as a child, less than 1% of the population, I'm talking about North American statistics, I'm talking about U.S. and Canada now, less than 1% of the people that have been abused will offend in a sexual abuse way. So that's a very small percentage that will reoffend, or not reoffend, but will offend because they've been offended, I should say. And it's funny we're talking about this because I was looking at the statistics not too long ago, and I was talking about it on my own radio show, and this question always comes up. And well, just because I was abused, does it mean I'm going to abuse? Well, no. That's another stigma that's been blown way out of proportion, and hopefully in time that'll change.
Yeah, I mean, I hope something like that will change. I think it's going to take a long time for us to get there. But how would you say that society should start to move towards that change? How do we tackle this?
Well, through awareness and through advocates like myself and others out there, this will change. And education. Actually, education is the biggest thing right off the hop. I don't know why I even think of that to begin with. Education in the schools, to start off with, is very, very important. I've been fortunate enough to go into, well, to a lot of universities and colleges now and talk about this. And this is one thing I always tell the students. Well, this is where the change starts. If you're educated, then when you go out in the real world and you become a, you know, whether you become a police officer or you become a judge or you become a prime minister, for example, or a justice chief or something like that, this is where the changes will come, because you will know and understand that this is that it's only just a very, very small, minute population of the population through the clinicians that are making these statistics and the justices that are making these statistics. You'll see that it's just a stigma, and it's not all of them. It's just a very small percentage.
Do you think that, so part of the education you'd mentioned, post-secondary, do you think we should start this education in elementary schools?
Well, yes. I think it should start in the elementary schools. I mean, it could be done very subtly, and you don't have to use names or slang or anything like that. It could be done very, very nice, like Dr. Seuss-like, as an example, you know, something very innocent. And even just something as simple as your parents, the parents talking about it very openly, which they don't. A lot of cultures do not even bring this up as a topic. I know even some cultures, they don't even have a word for it in their language, you know, sexual abuse. So that's where it needs to change. But starting in the schools is where it needs to change. And, you know, regardless of your culture or whoever, it makes no difference. Or your religion, it makes no difference who you are. It's not right. It's not the right thing to do.
I'm so happy you had even brought up the cultural piece, because one of our first guests for the sexual abuse series that we have done was Cheyenne. And she, please correct me if I'm wrong, Jen, but one of the main things she brought out was talking about culture and how important it is to understand about culture. And she used the concept cultural humility.
Yes, that's very...
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think, and I, every episode I try to stress this to the listeners, how important cultural humility is and how important it is for us to even bring it at the policy level, right? Because if we're talking about the education, then that's the ministry's ed, right? To really develop curriculum that is going to be developmentally appropriate for children, but also take into consideration the cultural humility perspective and all those other layers.
Yeah. If I can add something into that as well. Now, our Ontario government has implemented a new sex curriculum for the schools. And I mean, I have not completely observed it. I only heard little bits and pieces of it. But I do know for a fact that in the public schools, for example, they don't even touch base on this. If they do, it's very, very minimal. Mm-hmm. And I'm not very clear on it, so I can't really give a proper comment on that until I take a closer look at it. But I know it's grossly inadequate, what I've heard from people that have looked into it. And I think it's important that our government has done this, but I think it needs to be refined a little bit better. And I think it needs to be in school. I think it's great that kids know, you know, kids need to know about AIDS, kids need to know about STDs, kids need to know about homosexuality, you know, all the stuff that's coming out now. Like, I mean, the society is over innovated with this stuff, and the majority of the people don't even understand what it's all about. Never mind the adults, the kids. I mean, they know better than the adults do.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of change needs to be done.
Yeah. definitely.
And I think what she's done is a good thing, but I just think it needs to be refined a little bit better. And as far as sexual abuse is concerned for kids in school, I think it should start right from the beginning when they're in kindergarten 4, kindergarten 5, grade 6. I mean, it's just simple as saying is that no one can touch your body parts. You know, only your mummy or your daddy or something like that. I mean, as long as you're happy with it, you're comfortable with it. But other than that, no one should be touching you. Mm-hmm. Very simple things. I mean, maybe not worded the way I've worded it, but something very similar to that. And keeping it very simple and non-complicated, because you got to remember they're children. They're not adults.
Yes.
Or teenagers. So you have to go at it. You need to go at it in an approach where they're going to understand, and they may make fun of it. Who knows what they're going to do, how they're going to take it. But you got to start someplace. In my opinion.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And I think by the time, if it was implemented in, like, kindergarten, by the time post-secondary comes, there's such a depth of understanding about it.
It's not shock.
It's not shock. And I don't know the stats, you know, how many 1 in 5, or I don't know the stats entirely.
Yeah, 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 to 1 in 6.
So by that time, when you're in post-secondary, you know, there's probably someone in your circle of friends, let's say, that has possibly gone through this. So if you've learned from it from kindergarten, you have such a greater understanding then on how to deal with the issue. Yeah. And so I think it's a great point, and I hope that gets changed. I hope the listeners are listening. We're near the end of the show, which is saddening me because I think this is a great conversation, but we'll probably have you on again.
Oh, I'd be more than happy to.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask the very last questions, and the listeners know what's coming. I've been asking this question for the past 16 episodes. What does advocacy mean to you?
Well, I know we were talking about this earlier. What does advocacy mean to me? Well, now that I'm in a better place, as a human being, and doing what I'm doing here at the Gatehouse, well, you know, I came here as a victim, and I became a survivor, and now I'm a warrior. Mm-hmm. So now I'm a warrior that's advocating for childhood sexual abuse and domestic violence. There's a whole bunch of things that are attached to it, but primarily for childhood sexual abuse. So being an advocate means to me is being able to stand up in front of you and everybody else in the world and saying, this is wrong. Mm. Change needs to be done. It means going into the schools. It means going into the colleges, universities, as I pointed out about going in and talking about this where nobody else will talk about it. And it means going, whether it's the government heads or it's the police or to people who make the laws, and not being afraid to talk about it and not worrying about what somebody will say to you. So to me, being an advocate is being a warrior. And that's how I classify myself as now, because if people were to live how I've lived, and many others that I could talk about, they would be fighting back like I am now. I mean, actually, a lot of them are, but they would be doing and saying what I'm doing now as well.
I think that's such a great way to end the conversation. Jen, is there anything else you would like to add?
No, I think that was a really great conversation, and thank you for letting us interview.
My pleasure, Jen. Thank you anytime.
And I want to give you the last word, Stuart. Is there anything else you would like to add or feel that we haven't touched upon?
Well, I know we could probably talk for another hour. Yeah. There's a lot of things we didn't even touch base on. I know a couple of things we talked about. But if I could leave you with this, that if you are a victim out there or a survivor and you have no one to talk to, well, there is people out there that know about this stuff and know about it and know how to heal, like I am, like right here talking about it right now. So if you've had many doors closed, well, look up the Gatehouse, and you'll find that the doors will open here for you, as they have for me and thousands of others since 1998. So it's almost 20 years.
Wow. I didn't realize it's been that long.
Art Lockhart was the founder of the Gatehouse.
Yes.
And he started in 1998. Oh my gosh. If you thought there was nothing out there, there is. Granted, you need to be in the area or for reasonable amounts of, and there is other agencies out there that do cater to helping in regards to this matter. So there's not many, but there are there out there, and they're becoming and they're slowly becoming in the mainstream.
Thank you for that, and I will post the link to the Gatehouse at the bottom of the description for this episode. Your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. Thank you again, Stuart, for taking the time out to speak with me and Jen today. If you are a child or youth that would like to be on the show, or if you have an idea of a topic that we should be talking about, please email me or Jen at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That's yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.